First, though, in this hour, I want to talk to you about the way we treat prisoners when they're released from jail. Campaigners have sent Hertfordshire MP and Justice Secretary David Gawke a proposal to help convicts when they leave prison. And this is fascinating. They say ex-cons should be given a care package to help them get their teeth whitened, buy new clothes, get a haircut, remove tattoos, and take elocution lessons to help them get a job and move on in life. The package apparently could cost the taxpayer an estimated £1,000 per person. Well, in this hour, we're going to meet James Carre Rice. His criminality began at the young age of 16, when his parents' marriage broke down. He's spent time in Borstal and in prison. Guards called him a hopeless case, I gather. Then he was sent to the UK's only therapeutic prison, Grendon in Buckinghamshire, and his life turned round. He left prison in 1983, and since then he's spent time working for the New York State Criminal Justice Department. He's spoken in hundreds of prisons. He's written two books, Within These Streets and Another Kind of Knowing. We'll hear all about his life in this hour, and we'll find out why he's backing this plan to give prisoners a helping hand. But as always, phone lines are open for you if you want to join the conversation, if you want to get involved. Do you think we should give much more support to convicts when they leave prison? Here's the telephone number, 08081 00880. That's the number if you want to have your say this morning. James Carre Rice is a former convict, now writer, speaker and campaigner. He joins us now. Hello, James.
Oh, good morning, Jonathan. How morning. Are you today?
I'm well, thank you. So would you mind if we just go back to the beginning for you? I'm interested to know how you went off the rails. What caused it, do you think?
Oh, gosh, all sorts of reasons, I suppose. My family life was very harsh, very broken up, and lots of arguing, marriage breakup. And I was very clever at school, but my whole academic career went down the drain, and I suppose I look for more of family sort of connections out on the streets, you know. So
And of course, we see that pattern continuing today, don't we?
All the time, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So when you started to look for other influences on the street, was that, you know, a gang-type culture?
Yeah, yes, it was. I got involved in gangs. I think sometimes you're just trying to be somebody. You're trying to fit in life. And I think if your home's broken up and you can't be somebody there, you just seem to be a nuisance. You know, your parents have got no time for you. You'll try and be anything you can somewhere else. Some people act the clown. Other people can be one thing or another. For me, it was being tough, you know, fighting and things on the streets, yeah.
And that's how it all started then, just a bit
Pretty
of fighting.
Much, yeah. When I look back, I can see that I was just desperate to be somebody rather than be nobody, yeah.
When you got involved in this gang or in these gangs and you started becoming violent, how long was it before that behaviour escalated to the extent that you were then arrested and put in Borstal?
Oh, it all happened within a very short space of time, to be honest. I mean, by the time I was caught and placed in Borstal, you know, I could have been picked up at any time. And it was kind of almost inevitable. You kind of felt that, you know, you thought you know what you were heading for, but you didn't really, because once you get there, it's more hellish than you can ever imagine. And you think, oh my gosh, this is, you know, this sentence is all out of all proportions of what I've been involved in, you know.
So, and how old were you at that point?
I was 17 when I went to Borstal.
And what did you go to Borstal for?
I was supposed to be there for about 8 months, but I actually spent 2 years there. I was so bad, I caused just as much trouble in there as I did outside.
Did you? And what crime had you committed at that point to get you put into Borstal?
Oh, it was violence, yeah. It was never like just picking on members of the public. It was amongst my own people, if you know what I mean.
Right,
you know, there were gangs all over the place and we'd fight with each other. And, you know, it was always that kind of trouble, really, yeah.
And when you went into Borstal, I mean, I guess really if we're going to have the kind of penal system that we have in this country, you would like to think that particularly at an early stage in a Borstal, that there will be some attempt to rehabilitate people and to change their attitude. Was there any kind of rehabilitation in the Borstal that you went to?
Well, it was quite the opposite, to be honest with you. You know, when I was placed on remand, it was just completely brutal. And that's without being convicted at that point. And then I went to a prison where you wait to be allocated, and that was pretty brutal as well. And then the Borstal was just a terrible place, really. And in many ways, you know, we accepted it. You know, we knew we were wrong. We knew we'd done things wrong, and we just accepted it. But we were too young to realize at that point that we actually needed a lot of help. We needed somebody to say, well, okay, you've been punished, you've done wrong, and we accepted that. But what we didn't realize what we needed is somebody to say, well, where has it gone wrong and what can we do? You know, and what I realized as years went by is the public have become removed, the communities are removed from what goes on with criminals. You know, they're not going to stay in forever. It doesn't matter what you think of them. They're coming back into the community from the minute they become sentenced. So people need to be more concerned about, well, what kind of a character is going to show back up on the streets here?
But you see, one of the prevailing arguments that I hear on my programme, and I guess it makes sense from a logical perspective, is that if prison or Borstal is a thoroughly unpleasant and tough place, then your experience while you're in there is so awful that you kind of think to yourself, oh, I don't ever want to go back in there again. So that in itself acts as an incentive to improve your behaviour and not to come out and do the same thing again. Does it not work like that?
I think there's a part of that works. I mean, obviously, it's a hateful experience. I mean, the shame of being caught, the shame of public, you know, going to a court, you know, your fingerprints taken, photographs, it's in the newspaper, you get taken away. You're losing far more than just your liberty. You know, if you've got a flat, you've got children, you've got a wife, your job prospects, there's a whole raft of things that you lose. And quite rightly, that should hurt. And it should be very difficult experience, but it is within everyone's interest straight away to try to find out what's wrong and how can we reintegrate this person into the community, and what can the community do? Because the outcome is another £40,000 a year to keep somebody in, and yet it wouldn't cost even a fraction of that to actually keep them out. You know, so it does make sense. And when you talk about you know, the more horrific the experience is, that it would make people go the other way, it actually has the opposite effect. And you have to be a bit of a psychologist to understand how it works. But when I was in America, they used to do the thing called frighten people straight. And I used to go in and do these in America. They used to take young people who were scallywags heading towards trouble. And they used to go into the big penitentiaries and they'd do this scared straight. So these, you know, long-term prisoners, very scary characters, would tell them really how it was. But in the long term, when they studied these young people, they found that actually the scariness drew them towards the crime and drew them towards that which they feared.
That seems irrational.
Pardon?
That seems completely irrational. I mean, for most of us in life, when we witness something that is unpleasant, we try to do everything we can to avoid experiencing that again.
Yeah, I suppose really what it is that when you've got young people, in particular teenagers, they seem so grown up, but they're still, you know, putting life together. And the influences that we put upon them at a young age, even if it's something that scares them, the actual fear becomes their focus. And if you understand how people operate and how they work, Even if it's something you don't want, the more you focus upon it, the more you're drawing it into your life. And that's how. I mean, if you play golf, you know that. If there's a bunker up ahead, you don't want to go in the bunker. It's no good standing there saying, I don't want to go in the bunker, I don't want to go in the bunker, because that's your focus and that's what's going to happen. You know, It works in sport and it works in life. It's the same thing.
How interesting. So for you, how many times were you kind of in and out of prison / Borstal?
Yeah, I did some short sentences, and then they got a bit longer and longer.
Right.
I went in four times.
Okay. And those first few times that you ended up in there, mm-hmm. when you came out, how long was it before you reoffended?
Probably 6 months, something like that.
Right. And do you remember what led you to the pattern of reoffending?
I couldn't find my way. You know, when I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, because obviously I've written books about it and things, and helped other people, and I can remember becoming so alienated from society. You know, I didn't want to be. I wanted to come out, and I wanted to go to college, and I wanted to get a job and do things. But I had a lot of inadequacies, and I didn't really know, as a strapping young man, I didn't want to sit down and tell people how inadequate I felt or how lost I felt or lonely. It all seemed a bit soft, and didn't seem to be anybody I could communicate that to. And so you kind of hide it in alcohol. drugs. You know, you hide it in some bravado. And, of course, all of that's going to fall apart at some point, you know. So it was a disaster waiting to happen. And I see lots of young people like that now, you know. It's that kind of stuck in an image, you know. They need something to someone they can relate to get out of it, you know.
If you look at young people today, and am I right in thinking the last time you came out of prison was back in the 80s?
Yeah, that's right, 1983.
So you've kind of been on the straight and narrow now for many years.
Yeah.
When you see today's young men, who, and it is largely men, isn't it, who are going around committing these very similar kind of aggressive and violent crimes and are ending up going into prison and coming out and then going back in again, do you think that they are exactly the same as you? They're young men who, given the right guidance, could be helped, but they haven't been given the right guidance? Or are they, as some people would assume, listening to this programme, they're just young men who've been born as wrong'uns, and it doesn't matter what you do, they're always going to be wrong'uns, and actually the best thing to do is just to keep them locked up for their whole lives?
Well, that's quite a big question, really. I wouldn't really know that somebody should be locked up for their whole lives. I do know this, though, that it's a bit like healthcare, isn't it? Or your children. You know, you're raising your children and they go the wrong way. I've got three children, I've got four grandchildren, and they do things wrong, they go the wrong way. And some of them are a bit slower to get back on track than others. But the only reason they get back on track is because I was there to help them. And I'm still there to help them. You know, they're part of my life. And people who belong in our communities, you know, they need our assistance in the community all of their lives. You know, we can't just write people off. If you do that, you might as well not treat smokers anymore, or people who get obese, or people who drink all the time and then they have to need health care because of their drinking problem. But you're going to say you're not going to do it anymore. You know, maybe they were born to be drinkers, you know. It's hard to know where to draw the line with these things.
What was it worked for you at Grindon? I mean, what's the magic, the secret trick?
I think the thing for me was, I was desperate. I realised that I was wrong. I wasn't trying to say I was innocent. I wasn't trying to blame anybody else. I knew that I was broken and I needed to be fixed. And the thing that really turned it around for me was they actually offered me a chance. You know, I still feel emotional about that even to this day. I can still remember that. They weren't really sure about accepting me. They said probably I was too harsh, too tough. And then there was this doctor who said, you know, we're going to give you a chance. And I'll never forget his face. I'll never forget the chance he gave to me. And I went on the therapy. And the thing that really struck me was, you know, the hand has been offered out in a moment when I least deserved it, you know. And you could go back to the story of Les Miserables, Jean Valjean. We love the story because we know the end. But, you know, who really would have handed their hand out to him when he was in the depths of his crime, in the depths of his wrongdoing, you know?
So was this therapy in terms of looking back at your childhood, looking back at what went wrong, helping you piece together where you'd gone off the rails so that you then had the ability and the desire to change?
Very, very much so. I think one of the great things that happens in group therapy that was at Grendon was that you'd sit there and you're stuck in a framework of your own making. Everyone's got an ego and you can't see. It's like a glass wall and you're stuck inside of it. And but then you hear somebody telling the truth about themselves because they've been there longer than you. And they're comfortable talking about things that you're terrified to speak about. And you go back to your cell or you go walk around the yard or wherever you are and you think, you know what, that's true about me as well. And maybe I should tell the truth as well. And what you do by telling that truth is you're starting to dismantle this tough exterior. You know, I sat on the group one day and I said to them, look, you know, I said, I've come to realize something, that nobody has ever known me and I've never been true to myself. Everything about me is false. Everything I say, the way I walk, the way I act, you know. And when I realized that, you know, as an individual, I was only 22 then, I made it my goal to break that false image to pieces, which I did. And what emerged was a much nicer person. He'd been there all along. I was actually quite nice underneath. You know, I wasn't anything like what people thought I was.
No, I was going to say, and you come across, I'm sure everybody listening to you speaking this morning will agree. I mean, you appear to be a very nice man, a very kind and gentle man. That's how you strike me anyway. I can't, when you're talking about this other version of you, the previous version, I find it difficult to imagine. But you are also very articulate. You're clearly also very intelligent and you're a thinker.
Yes.
Do you think that this kind of therapy Does this work with people who are not as intelligent as you, who are not thinkers like you? Are they able to analyse their own personality and their own flaws and put it all together in a meaningful way?
Well, obviously, each person is different. Some people in any tribe of people, any family or community, some people are very slow and they will keep making mistakes. But one of the things that happened in Grendon, it's an interesting finding about all the therapy there, was that, you know, you've got all sorts of people, even people unwilling, not very willing on the groups, you know. So they'd be there, and like I should say, they're not that intelligent and they're not that clever. But what they found in Grendon over the years was there's a much less reoffending went on. But more importantly as well as that, it was the degree of severity of crime dropped significantly with everybody. And really? That doesn't happen anywhere else. You know, usually it actually increases, it goes the other way. So there's an effect there. It's very difficult on a short interview like this to talk about, you know, explain how that works. But anybody who begins to tell the truth about who they really are and who they're really not goes a long way to breaking down this destructive behaviour that they're in. So
These campaigners who have written to the Hertfordshire MP and Justice Secretary David Gawk with this proposal for ex-convicts when they leave prison, with this care package to help those ex-convicts get their teeth whitened, buy new clothes, get a haircut, remove tattoos, take elocution lessons, help them get a job and move on in life. I understand that the cost to the taxpayer will be about £1,000 a person. And am I also right in understanding that you are a supporter of this idea?
Well, what I'm a supporter of is that the community needs to be more knowledgeable and understanding about why the system doesn't work at all. And it just doesn't work. It doesn't matter how cruel you get, how harsh it gets, what you don't give them, how you like people like to keep condemning somebody when the sentence is all over. Don't forget, I'm talking about people who are not criminals anymore. It's past now. They're out. And they've got as much right as anybody else. Everybody needs some help in life, you know. If you don't help them, you're facing crime on the community, so that's damaging. Trouble on the streets, that's damaging. People don't like it. You know, people don't like thugs hanging around parks and things like that. And that's how things will end up if you don't help them, because they'll just find their own people. They'll join back in groups like that. But if you can help them break out of that, then not only the cost, the physical cost, you know, just in monetary terms, it's £40,000 a year to keep that person in the jail for 1 year. But if you're going to spend maybe just a few £100 because they needed a suit or a decent haircut, gets a job, I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense. And even if out of 20 people, it doesn't really work, well, what about the 7 it did work for? I'm one of those 7 it could be out of the 20. I've spent 35 years helping people nonstop. And in our country, and this is a story that nobody really knows, in our country, it's full of people who are helping at the harshest end of society in, you know, homelessness, in social work and all sorts. And you'll find that most of them came out of bad situations and they had to work their way out like I did. And they invariably turn around and put that right back into the community. And they reach people that sort of average people would never reach. They wouldn't go near. So there's a sort of army out there of people who could be turned around. And they're the ones who do some of the greatest work you can imagine.
But isn't the reality that the £1,000 to give convicts, you know, a haircut and a nice suit and whiten their kind of their brown teeth that are making them look terrifying in job interviews and all those other kinds of things, that surely is the very end of the story, and a huge amount of effort and finance-driven effort would have to go into the prison with those convicts before they're released in order for this to be the success story that you're talking about?
Well, this is exactly the story. I mean, this proposal is like putting a plaster on a disease. You know, it wouldn't work in and of itself. In my opinion, there almost needs to be drawn a line. Say people age 24 and lower, everything should be done not to put them in a prison and treat them so harshly. You know, they should. I mean, many of them need to be removed from the streets. The public, it's absolutely critical that we look after victims. It's critical that we look after the community. But if you're going to do that in the long run, if I care about people, if I care about the community, I want to do something, I want to make sure that this 18, 19, 20-year-old doesn't become hardened in a prison. I want them to face up to what they've done, face the community. They never face anybody. They reckon psychologically a prisoner would rather do 18 months to 2 years in a prison rather than face the people they committed the crimes against. Even the guy in Toronto last night, he ran over people on the streets and the police cornered him and he was shouting at them, shoot me, shoot me. You know why? Because he can't face his shame. But the best thing anyone can do is face the shame, face your community, but then let the community help you, you know? So you're absolutely right. I agree with you entirely. It needs to be thought out from the inception all the way through to possibly handing out some things that may help in the process.
But of, but of course, the reality is that that will come at such a huge cost, and I don't know whether actually the public are prepared for our tax money to be used in that way. At a time when you look at elderly people who are not being cared for properly in the community, who are being sent out of hospital and they're having to wait with inadequate care packages and all that kind of stuff, how on earth could people say, yeah, but that's fine, let's spend millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds on prisoners? Rehabilitating prisoners, trying to get them better. I mean, I guess there'll be people who'll say those youngsters, they were all born with a decent opportunity, the same as everyone else. If they've mucked it up, that's their fault, not the rest of society. And why should society just have to keep paying?
Yeah, I understand that completely. I understand, you know, what people say. When I was in prison years ago, the prison population was below 50,000. And they used to say, well, if it reaches 50, oh my gosh, you know. Well, it's doubled now. Mm-hmm. And so everything, if you can imagine this, everything that was being done then hasn't worked. You know, somewhere along the line, somebody's got to say, well, let's do something that does work. Yeah. Well, because it's already costing billions. It's costing billions in crime. It's costing billions for victims. It's costing all the way around. You have to pay all the staff. You've got to build the walls and the justice system and everything mm-hmm. else. Because if it's not working and it's ballooning out of control, which it clearly is, then somebody somewhere needs to make a brave decision and say, well, how should we reallocate this money? Because it's not being spent very well.
James?
It's almost criminal the way that we approach the whole thing, you know.
It's fascinating speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan.